From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We spoke with Tony live from Managua via Skype on Monday. This coming week is a lot to cover, of course, but last week we saw the summit of the BRICS countries, and among the BRICS countries, of course, is Brazil, being the brick in that wall from Latin America, Caribbean region, South America to be specific.
Yeah, and the BRICS summit is always very important because precisely for Latin America, certainly precisely because of Brazil's role as one of the founding countries of the BRICS. But in the current context, and the interesting thing for you and me in particular, given the conversations that we've had about the Latin America's position in the global context for many months, we've been discussing this, is that the right-wing government of the usurper president Michel Temer continues to give extremely high priority to these BRICS summits.
Right.
And that is an indication of the extent to which the Latin American right-wing oligarchic elites recognize that the United States is in decline. The United States is essentially a financialized economy and has very little to offer by way of productive investment that's going to increase the wealth of the societies of the countries in Latin America. And that fundamental recognition is forcing, as it were, the Latin American elites to cut some kind of deal and engage in some way, whether enthusiastically or not, with the structures that are being developed by the Russian Federation and China in particular.
Right.
But as you and I saw just earlier when we were talking about the whole BRICS system, before we started this conversation, and the reality is that Russia and China are bending over backwards to treat their other BRICS partners as full equals and taking into consideration all their concerns.
Yeah.
And that's reflected in the fact, for example, that in the BRICS documents that you and I had a chance to review quickly before we started talking, there's no mention, for example, of the thorny relationship of China with Pakistan.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
One of the interesting things about all this is that there's a boring level of mundane humdrum activity that is going to go on below the headlines.
Right, like normality, like it almost is becoming routine now. There are these processes that are in motion that are, you know, that spring from this new multipolarity that almost feel boring because, hey, this multipolarity thing is just like ongoing, like processes, like when people go to work. It's just becoming normalized. And, you know, on that point, before we get any deeper, I see where you're going. But so this one this year was BRICS in Africa. It was held in Johannesburg. Collaboration for Inclusive Growth and Shared Prosperity in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And they discuss in particular engaging with South Africa and other African nations to help develop infrastructure there. And next year, it's going to be Brazil. And you can bet, again, that this is going to be the emphasis. We'll be looking at the region, Latin America and the Caribbean, as one ripe for, you know, further infrastructure development. And so it's interesting that they're focusing on this. And, you know, this is signed by all five parties, Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, even though you've had these contradictions at the head of state level, whether in Brazil with the coup that you mentioned, in essence of Tamer, the usurper president. In India, as Modi goes, you know, blows with the wind one way or the other in terms of the geopolitical contest between the hegemony model and the multipolarity model, or more specifically, the U.S. and EU on one side and the rest of the world on the other. It seems like this kind of multipolar organization is so regularized that even as they attempt, the U.S. and others attempt to put the genie back in the bottle and sacrifice all this on the altar of hegemony, they have to use the multipolar institutions to do it because they're so, you know, so firmly developed at this point. Not maximum, but enough where you can't just go, and it's gone.
Yeah, and I think that, and the going back to what you said about this particular BRICS summit being focused on Africa, and there's so much similarity between the geopolitical trends as they affect Latin America and the geopolitical trends as they affect Africa. What's going on in Africa? China is investing in enormous infrastructure projects as part of its Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road Initiative, that they hope will integrate important parts of Africa's economy into the Eurasian economy that they're trying to develop.
The string
There's
of
so
pearls
many
also.
Pieces to this, Don.
That's like the string of pearls is also part of that. That you know, the part that stretches to Africa is the part.
Yeah,
of that.
And just really boring things like electricity generation.
Right.
Integration. I mean, that's currently going on, and there was an article on the web recently by a guy looking at electricity generation integration in Central Asia between the former Central Asian Soviet republics, and like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, all those countries, and all that is going on underneath the headlines that the mainstream corporate media can deliberately hide from people, as it were. And I think they do it deliberately, because what it means is that the world is moving. It's just moving on ahead. I mean, the Eurasian Economic Union is going to engage with the BRICS countries. It's going to engage with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, of which some of them are member countries. And they're going to engage with the China Belt and Road, Silk Road Initiative. And all that is going to integrate into Africa, right? And so, but what does the United States have to offer Africa? Well, it's AFRICOM. And that's about it.
That's right.
You know, or extractive corporate activities.
Well, they go hand in hand. I mean, you know, AFRICOM basically is the gun that they point in the face of the people there when they say, okay, go dig up all your stuff over there and carry it to my boat over here.
Right, AFRICOM, yeah. And so that's the United States approach. Yeah. And they use the direct military approach. And the European Union mixed that military approach, principally via France's interventions in Mali, in Central Africa, and elsewhere, with the economic approach, whereby France in particular has reactivated its deep colonial control of in particular of West Africa in the service of to the European Union, in the sense that it gives a strong access to resources and financial control of what's the population of West Africa, something like 200 and something million, and more than that. But and they are completely controlled financially by the Central Bank of France.
Right.
And so all that, you have to juxtapose all that against what China is offering. While the European Union and the United States are sucking all they can of the lifeblood of Africa to sustain their own rotten economies and their own rotten corporate-based societies, China is offering Africa infrastructure development and social and economic development that will give autonomy and self-sustainability to Africa's economies.
Right.
Now, if you transfer that to Latin America, you see exactly the same kinds of patterns.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what does the United States have to offer Latin America? Well, subjugation to the United States' failed financialized economy that depends on this massive kind of shell game of trying to sustain their economy without real productive investment. That's the key thing. The fundamental thing is investment. Now, the United States doesn't invest anything in the development of the productive capacity of Latin America to speak of.
That's right.
And it's all financialized extraction.
That's right.
And as one can see in Argentina, for example, where they have this current crisis where the government of Mauricio Macri is now hopelessly in hock to the International Monetary Fund that has essentially taken over control of Argentina's domestic economy.
It's amazing how little time it took to undo the work that was done in like 15 years by Nestor Kirchner and Cristina Kirchner. It took Macri, when did he get elected? In December of 2015?
November 2015.
Okay. So it's not even 3 years yet that he's been in office, and he was able to undo like 15 years worth of work straightening out accounts with exactly all of those vultures. And I don't just mean the vulture funds that the vultures on Wall Street call vultures, which, however, is expert testimony on the matter. But the actual vultures that the actual vultures on Wall Street have, and your all of the institutions that carry this to the four corners of the earth, the IMF, the World Bank, etc. You have all of that. Let me give a quick outline from this document because it's useful to take a look at that also. You have a willingness to engage here by the BRICS countries that is. Really further developed from even last year. The second item on their outline is to strengthen multilateralism. They're talking globally. In other words, let's keep developing this model going forward. And Brazil is signing this. I want to emphasize that again. For example, reforming global governance and addressing common challenges. Okay, they also go to strengthening and consolidating BRICS cooperation in international peace and security. They want to have a footprint, in the midst of the international order. Then BRICS partnership under item 4 for global economic recovery, reform of financial and economic global governance institutions, and the fourth industrial revolution. I mean, these are big goals for this thing that's taking. And then people-to-people cooperation, and they go into the things people are more used to after that.
Yeah, and if you look at events in Latin America where the United States has used its corrupt local partners to attack the national sovereignty of governments in Latin America, that's the essential thing. The United States has to destroy national sovereignty in Latin America and the Caribbean because that is the only protection the peoples of the region have against corporate predators. So.
Right.
So the going back to Argentina now, I compare that to what happened in Chile with the coup in 1973, and what was the coup? What was if you look beyond the horror of the coup, and the human cost of the coup? What did that mean in geopolitical terms for the United States? It meant that the United States was able to impose its neoliberal model that later came to be called the Washington Consensus, and it defended that by a vicious abuse of human rights and the destruction of civil society in Chile.
I mean, these are the things that are being offered now for economic and domestic policy neoliberalism and for international policy and for both foreign policy from the local up and from the grand down. Neocon policy. So
I want to stick with Argentina because
But that's what I'm saying.
In Argentina, what you see in Argentina now is the Macri government is saying that Macri has just, by presidential decree, changed Argentina's constitution to allow the army to have responsibility in some areas of domestic public order. Okay, so I'm. What is that? That is a kind of a slightly paler reflection of what Pinochet did in Chile.
Right. It's necessary, though, because when they start carrying people's goods out of their houses and shipping them off to New York or Miami or wherever, some of those people get very unhappy. And they express their displeasure. They try first through the political institutions, and when they fail, they take up arms or they sit on their hands in the streets or they resist. And so if you're going to survive that as a group imposing this on people, well, you got to have the army at the ready, basically. And so they're getting ready.
In the current context in Argentina, Macri's move is extremely controversial because, like today, the teachers' unions in Argentina have started a 48-hour strike. No. So, and that's the context in which Macri has said, well, let's get the army to control public order in some cases.
Right?
So, and what's going to happen over the next few months? Are we going to see the Argentinian armed forces repressing Argentinian teachers and nurses and doctors? Is that what we're going to see? We don't know. But that's the obvious fear. That's not a theoretical fear. It's not hypothetical because just across the border from Argentina in Brazil, you have large areas of, for example, Sao Paulo and other important urban centers that have been completely militarized. But that doesn't get reported in The Guardian, the BBC, the New York Times, or National Public Radio or Democracy Now!, right?
Right.
That it doesn't exist as far as all those phony media are concerned.
That's right.
And so... But it's a very real concern for people in Argentina when Macri brings in this measure that is being challenged in the legislature, by the way, in a context in which just across the border in Brazil, in very important urban centers have been militarized with deaths and everything that's associated with the militarization of public spaces.
Right. Well, I mean, look, there's the whole history in Argentina of military involvement in domestic politics and people being disappeared and executed and, you know, juntas and all of that stuff. And there were reforms that were intended to fix this, including a decree in 2006 that limited the armed forces to defense against external attack. And,
correct.
And that is now what is being, Mauricio Macri has attempted to, or claims to have, removed. And then, as you said, that is being fought domestically.
Yeah. So then, and all that's happening in a context in which, for example, the US allies are engaged in a kind of somewhat paradoxical relationship in terms of developing their neoliberal-based model, a corporate-led model that they claim will lead to prosperity for everybody. Ha ha!
Right.
You know, and it's just, and so, but that's the propaganda. The propaganda is from countries like Chile, Peru, Colombia, and the current government of Mexico, led by outgoing President Peña Nieto, is that their Pacific Alliance neoliberal corporate trade-led policies will somehow magically bring prosperity to their country's impoverished majority.
Right.
And so they're engaged with China, they're engaged with the countries of what's the kind of reborn Trans-Pacific Partnership without the United States, which the United States under President Trump may well end up in the most humiliating way possible trying to rejoin. But these Pacific Alliance countries took a very important step in regional terms last week when they held a summit with the countries of Mercosur.
Yep.
Mercosur is the kind of has been a moribund trade bloc originally formed by Brazil, Argentina, and their two tiny neighbors, Paraguay and Uruguay, tiny comparatively.
And those
four countries attempted an expansion in the first decade of this current century tried to incorporate Venezuela, tried to incorporate Bolivia.
Right.
But now the right-wing governments in Brazil, Argentina, and Paraguay have excluded Venezuela, even though Venezuela legally can't be excluded from Mercosur. They've they just took the arbitrary ad hoc decision to exclude Venezuela.
Yep, they're suspended is the term of art they use. Yeah.
They suspended Venezuela. And they're refusing to ratify the incorporation of Bolivia. Mm-mm. And so that's on the level of the battle for regional integration, that's quite a serious setback for progressive countries like Bolivia and Venezuela. It's not the end of the world because things change.
Right.
And maybe I don't know if we'll have time to talk about the Brazilian election before we finish. But the important thing is that these leaders, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Argentina, met with the leaders of the Pacific Alliance countries, Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile, and they made an agreement to advance their version of Latin American and Caribbean integration.
Right.
But the interesting thing about that is, well, what's going to be the role of Mexico once Andrés Manuel López Obrador assumes the presidency later this year? Will he be as favorable to the kind of integration, corporate-led integration, that the Pacific Alliance have been pushing to date? It's unlikely that he's going to make any radical change in Mexico's position on that, but there will be a change in some sense in the way that López Obrador and his diplomatic team try and project their interest in developing the Pacific Alliance. It's likely to be less favorable. Mexico's policy is likely to be less favorable towards global corporate interests than that of the government of Peña Nieto.
I mean, that's going to be the test,
How seriously will that affect the overall policies of the Pacific Alliance and this process towards neoliberal neoliberal model of integration? Who knows?
Right.
But the interesting thing about it, Don, is that as we've been saying for months, and the United States does not have a decisive role in that anymore.
That's right.
Because it's so focused on Latin America's relationship with Asia and in particular China.
Yeah, there are objective reasons for the United States not to have such a large role anymore. They spring out of the long history. Some of it rests just on popular sentiment on the ground as a consequence of that history. And other, a major portion of it has to do with just the objective conditions, globally. This model of multipolarity isn't just some exercise taking place in a classroom. It translates into, thousands, even millions of business transactions on a daily basis, all kinds of human activity on the ground that, is oriented and or directed in different ways than it was during the period of hegemony. And so the United States can't step in, for example, and, say on television to the leaders of, say, five South American countries, okay, this is what you're going to do when you get up tomorrow morning. If we let you have your coffee, it's after your coffee. They can't do that anymore. Instead, they have all kinds of, first of all, China's there saying, well, we have some green tea and we have some excellent coffee. And by the way, we were thinking of just going out and laying in the sun in the afternoon. Why don't you come with us? We have some business to discuss. There's a whole different objective condition that exists where the guy with the gun telling you to give him your stuff isn't the only guy in town anymore.
And we're going to see that, aren't we, with the development of the United States was able to block Nicaragua's attempt to work with China to build an interoceanic canal, at least for the moment.
Yep.
But they're not going to be able to block the transoceanic railway that's going to run from Peru through Bolivia and Brazil and Paraguay.
Right.
Even the Pacific Alliance and Mercosur countries want to see happen.
That's right. That there are stops all along that rail from the Pacific to the Atlantic that will become areas of development, hubs of development for the interior of this huge continent called South America. And everybody involved wants to make money on it, believe me.
Yeah, and what has been the U.S. contribution in that context? Their contribution has been to set up more military bases in the region.
Yeah, that we're not building a railroad we want your stuff, put it on the back of a mule and send it out to the coast where our boat's waiting. They don't build railroads to help loot, you know, to help you help them loot you. They don't even
That is very telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the contrast is really damning.
Yep.
I mean, the United States is good at kind of setting up military bases and intimidating governments via Wall Street.
That's right.
But it's absolutely hopeless at any kind of productive investment that's going to transform Latin American productive capacity.
Right. That's right. By its nature, I mean, if there were steel available for a railroad, they would sell the steel at a discount to somebody and just cash it out. It's a financialized economy. It does not have a stake in developing infrastructure anymore, according to its own rules.
Right. So then, and regionally, and I don't know if you've got time to look at stuff in Ecuador and Colombia, for example, but...
Yeah, we have about 3 minutes left.
Okay, so, and it's worth bearing in mind that in the context that we've just been talking about, the kind of turncoat government of President Lenin Moreno in Ecuador is also looking at joining the Pacific Alliance, and a symbol of that is the way that it's decided to try and sell off the headquarters in the Ecuadorian capital Quito of the Union of South American Nations, and there's a huge social protest against that currently going on in Ecuador.
Yep. I guess they also plan to rent out the space that Julian Assange has been occupying in the London, where the ambassador is in London, the London mission, because apparently his departure, Assange's departure from the embassy in London is imminent, according to the reports we heard over the weekend.
Yeah, and that's just another example of the way Ecuador, under Lenin Moreno, whose popularity has slumped way below 50% now,
yep,
after initially being quite popular until people realize what he really was,
right,
really is.
Right.
And he says that he's been negotiating Assange's departure with the British government for some time.
Yep. Yeah, we're finding out an awful lot about Lenny's... I don't know that Lenny's going to end up serving out his whole term, because he ran on exactly on a platform that is exactly the opposite of what he's implementing. He ran against, as a matter of fact, the platform that he's implementing. And he did so, you know, rather eloquently and very effectively. He won, you know, handily. Because A, of what he was saying, and B, because of the enormous popularity of President Correa, who endorsed him. And now he's doing exactly what he, you know, criticized so effectively on the one hand as policy, and he's also at the same time been attacking former President Correa almost from out of the gate when he took office.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that's just another example of the way that, and if, although people may be fooled for a while by these individuals like Moreno, like Macri, and like Temer and the others, and they very quickly realize what the reality is, because they have to live that.
That's right.
Material economic reality.
That's exactly right. These people are looting you for a reason. Why? Because at the end of the day, they want your stuff. When you wake up and your stuff is gone, the first thing you say is, hey, where'd my stuff go? And then when you answer the question, you say, oh, that guy. Okay. And then you settle accounts.
Right.
All right, we've got a minute left. What's happening in Nicaragua? Is it normalizing?
Well, and here, it's the same story here. And people were fooled for maybe week, 2 weeks, max 3 weeks by the right-wing claims of government repression, which were completely false, and the calls for the government to resign. People were fooled by that for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and now they realize that it was all a big lie.
Yep, and so they're actually going for that same game in Moscow right now, apparently. You know, there's a just the central theme being a change in pensions. There's a substantial proposal that's been proposed in Russia and to up the retirement age 5 years almost for men. And there was a response from that, which made the media, and it made it look like the people are going in the streets in Moscow and around Russian. I thought to myself, gee, didn't we just go through this in Nicaragua? Where are the students? So, but we'll talk about that next week. And also, we have a little more to go to cover, particularly talk about Uribe and some of the other things that are happening in the region. Tony, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thanks to you, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.